Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Eminem, Indie Stats and Kid Rock. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
And hello, listeners. Welcome back. Or welcome for the first time, if indeed it is your first time here. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
Good.
That was me pretending to be a first-time listener.
you probably have listened to it before.
I was playing the role of a first-time listener. I listened to every edition before it goes out, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Apart from the first one back, the first edition as set list, due to all-round busyness, neither of us really listened to the whole thing before it went out. That was a bit of a risk to take on our big comeback edition, wasn't
it? That's just us, though, isn't it?
So
that's why the second episode was so much better.
So why not go back and listen to the first edition of the podcast as set list, which neither of us had listened to before we put out, and see why it was a bit rubbish.
It wasn't great. It wasn't rubbish. We just waffled a bit.
It was a top edition. This week on set list. That sounds like I'm repeating the bit that you do at the start. You've already done that. This week on set list, we are recording from a different room.
Yeah.
We're not in the usual studio. We're in a bigger room.
It sort of looks a bit like a mini one show.
It does, actually. It does look a little bit like a TV studio.
Which is of no use to us, really.
We really should have brought in a camera. This was our opportunity.
I can film it on my phone.
This was our opportunity to turn Setlist into a YouTube channel, and then we could become YouTube superstars and do big brand deals and then give all of this up. This was our opportunity, but we didn't bring in the camera. So we can't do it. But we are in a room that looks a little bit like a TV studio, although it's a bit bigger and we're overlooking the street. So we're wondering whether or not there'll be a little bit of an echo on this podcast. There may be some sirens going past, although it's a quiet street, isn't it? It's not a busy main road we're overlooking.
Is any street in London quiet, though, really?
Not really. So whereas normally we overlook the weird back of a building and to a hotel across a little area, we are now overlooking a street, so therefore there may be street sounds. There may be some ambiance on this edition of Setlist, but we're not on the ground floor, so it's not like the one show in that respect. It does feel a bit like the one show, but we're not on the ground floor, so you won't get people. I don't watch the one show. Do they ever have people in the background?
I don't know why you're asking me.
Do you not watch the one show?
No.
Because actually, now I come to think of it, when you go to...
We're both under 60.
My mum and dad watch it just so they can moan about it relentlessly. They don't enjoy the one show, but they really enjoy moaning about the one show.
Isn't that
show.
Why they listen to Chris Evans as well?
It's also why they listen to the Chris Evans radio show. So you can imagine when Chris Evans is presenting the one show, which he used to do on a Friday. I don't know if he still does.
You know a lot about it for someone who doesn't watch
that's
it.
That's the double whammy. But now I come to think of it, if you go to Broadcasting House when they're filming the one show, they do have a little fence around the window by the studio, and I think there's a security guard stopping anybody from actually standing there. So you can walk past it, but you can't actually stand there. A bit like when This Morning used to be done from the Albert Dock in Liverpool.
People did stand there, though, didn't they?
Only if it was a super celebrity. But most days, I remember this from my childhood when we used to go to Liverpool, there would be a security guard just off camera, and if you tried to stand there while Richard and Judy were having a chat, then he would wave you on and say, you can't stop, you got to move on. I do seem to remember there was an edition of This Morning. I don't know why this is stuck in my memory. There was an edition of This Morning featuring Chesney Hawkes. The week Chesney Hawkes was a thing. And that was just loads of screaming fans in the background.
Don't talk down to Chesney Hawkes. I have a fondness for Chesney Hawkes. I will not let you talk him down. he sent my sister a message for her wedding.
Did he?
Yeah. That's a whole other story.
It is a whole other story. I feel there may not be time on this edition.
There's
of
not.
List.
There's not. I'm just going to leave that hanging.
Maybe we could save that for the Christmas special.
Yeah.
That could be a
could be the whole Christmas special.
A special treat as to why Chesney Hawkes sent a message to... What did he send the message to?
My sister.
On her wedding day.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Look at that. Talk about claims of fame. That sort of outdoes my celebrity cold. Which is still here, by the way, on month... No,
I've got it now.
You've got it now. Yeah. Did you catch it last week? Because I was in the studio.
Well, I don't know. I've got children, so you never really know where a cold's come from.
It could be one of many germs that have entered your household. My cold had gone by the weekend, and then it came back on Monday.
Oh, so maybe you caught mine.
What's that? Sunday I was fine, and then Monday fully back into full-on cold. But it has sort of softened for today, which is just as well, because it means I can sit here and discuss the week in the music business on the Setlist Podcast in this almost TV studio that we're in.
Yeah, well, let's drag it back. We're talking about TV, actually, and the music business. I've been watching the Nile Rodgers 3-part documentary on the BBC, How to Make It in the Music Business, because I wanted to know how you make it in the music business.
How do you make it in the music business?
You be Nile Rodgers the conclusion.
Good tip. Being Chesney Hawkes isn't enough, but if you're Nile Rodgers, you will make it in the music business.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's a weirdly framed thing where they've given it this title. I think they must have given it the title first, and then at some point they've gone, oh, we'd better do something that makes it look like it's about making it in the music business. So they just sort of every now and then stick up a title card that says, know your fan base or something. And then it goes back into the interview with Nile Rodgers. It's a very good... It's worth 3 hours of your time.
So it's on the BBC iPlayer. Mm-hmm. I deleted the BBC iPlayer from my I don't own a TV, as I think you know. So I don't own a television. Actually, there's a big television here in this little studio.
You don't own it.
I could take that home with me tonight. But I don't own a TV. I have an iPad. I used to have the iPlayer on there, but my iPad's quite old now. You know, of old iPads, it gets to the point where just opening anything requires deleting 18 apps in order to get the one app you want to open. So I deleted the iPlayer because I don't really watch much BBC TV. I'm a bit of a Netflix, Amazon Prime, YouTube person. Is it worth me reinstalling the BBC iPlayer? I was thinking of doing that for research for CMU because I think it's tomorrow as we record this, last Friday as you listen to it, that dreadful sounding new music show.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
What's it called? The Sound of Friday Night?
Sounds Like Friday or something.
Sounds Like Friday is coming. Everyone's going to say it's the new Top of the Pops.
No, well, I saw an article. I didn't read the article, but I saw the headline. That's enough, isn't it? If you go by 70% of our readers. It said that it's not the new Top of the Pops.
Not the new Top of the Pops.
It's very different and it's good.
Right.
That is, I think, the gist of the article.
Despite the celebrity co-hosts and the comedy skits that we are being promised. So as this goes out, if you were to have the iPlayer on your device of choice, not only could you watch the Nile Rodgers 3-part documentary, you could also watch the first edition of that and see whether or not it is actually a really great show. Hurrah! Music back in primetime on the BBC, or if it is actually as shit as it sounded when it was first press released to us a couple of months ago.
I'm sure it's brilliant. But the Nile Rodgers thing, if you install the app and that's bad, you should watch the Nile Rodgers thing, because that is good.
Right. I'll make a mental note to do that in the next 7 days, if we ever get round to actually recording this podcast. What are we talking about this week?
Well, this week, we're going to talk about some new stats about the global market share of independent records and the independent record business. We're going to talk about how Kid Rock is not entering politics.
And never was.
Can't believe you even thought he was, just because he kept saying he was. But first, let's talk about Eminem and all the money he's getting from the ruling party in New Zealand.
It's 600 grand, but that's New Zealand dollars.
Which, yeah, I think it's about 400,000 American dollars.
And that's presumably what Eminem gets just by leaving the house in the morning. But even though the damages aren't perhaps the mega bucks damages that we would usually associate with a superstar rapper court case, this is a very interesting legal dispute, and lawyers representing Eminem and his music publishing company were adamant that the ruling in the New Zealand courtroom this week set a very important precedent. So we should probably recap what this story is all about.
So back in 2014, the New Zealand election campaign, the National Party, which went on to win the election, put out a campaign advert which featured a piece of music. The piece of music was not by Eminem, but it was called Eminem-esque, and it was called that because it sounded a bit like Lose Yourself.
You say a bit like. It sounded quite a lot like.
All right. Well, that's why Eminem's getting all this money. As happens when people don't want to spend a lot of money licensing a big, expensive, famous track for their advert. They went to a production music company. They went and paid for this track, Eminem-esque, which, as I say, was intended to sound a bit like Lose Yourself, but not so much that it would result in copyright infringement claims.
Although, in some email exchanges that happened between people working for the National Party, and these were emails that were subsequently presented in the court case by Eminem's side, although they had gone to a production music library and they'd gone through and searched for a track and they'd taken this track called Eminem-esque, which as far as they were concerned and presumably as far as the paperwork that came from this production music library said was fine for them to use, it wasn't a direct ripoff of Lose Yourself. But there was an email conversation between people involved in the campaign in which they basically said, this sounds really like an Eminem track. People are going to accuse us of ripping off Eminem. Whether or not by that they anticipated the person who would accuse them of ripping off Eminem to be Eminem, I don't know. But his music publishing company, which is called 8 Mile Style, then did subsequently sue.
Yes, and partly that's because, I mean, it's always controversial when this happens with any kind of advert, but when it's, as we've discussed before, when it's a political party using someone's music without their direct permission, effectively making it look like that artist is endorsing them, that's where it gets a bit sketchy.
Yeah, and as we discussed the other week when it was party conference season here in the UK, if a political party makes use of a track at an event, like a party conference, and that then gets shown on TV, actually there's nothing an artist can do about that, because when music is used in that way, it is covered by the blanket licenses from the collecting societies, and so the artists can't say no. But when a track is actually synced into an advert, well, at that point, you do need permission from the artist, or at the very least from the copyright owner, who would probably need to get the approval of the artist if they didn't own the rights themselves. Unless, of course, as happened here, you take a piece of production music where it seems like, by just paying some money to this library, you are allowed to use the track. And indeed, once Eminem and 8 Mile Style had sued, and then the National Party were having to defend themselves, that was the argument that they put forward. They said, we went to a production music library, we filled out the forms, we paid the money, we did this totally legit. And then they threw in a few things saying, anyway, Eminem's Lose Yourself, it's just a pop song, isn't it? All pop songs sound the same.
Yeah, as well as saying, we licensed this, it was all above board. One of their arguments was, it's not a very original track anyway. And who could tell, really? It could be any number of tracks. Although the judge specifically did not agree with that case, which is interesting. That normally when you get judges commenting on pop music, it's them saying, I've never heard of this band or artist.
Or trying to sound like they have no appreciation of contemporary music in any way.
Yes, whereas in this case, the judge went as far as in their ruling said it's a highly original work and laid down some sort of opinion on popular culture there.
So Eminem's publishing company sued the National Party last year. As we say, from the off, they were very much not our problem. We licensed this music legitimately. The whole thing went to court earlier this year, and we reported on it at the time in the CMU Daily. But the development this week is that the judge finally made his ruling on the matter, made those comments that you've already referenced, and I suppose the important part of the ruling was where he said, yep, this Eminem-esque production music track and Eminem's Lose Yourself, they are substantially the same piece of music, and therefore, by using Eminem-esque, that was copyright infringement. Although I would assume the National Party, who may as yet appeal this judgment, but would also presumably go back to this production music library and say, what were you doing licensing this piece of music that it turns out you didn't have the rights to license us? But it was the National Party who actually used the copyright infringing piece of music in that advert. Hence why they are being held liable and they are being ordered to pay this $600,000 of New Zealand dollars to Eminem's publishing company to make up for that infringement.
And because of, as we said, there were emails that were submitted as evidence that showed that they were aware of the similarities, even though they later claimed that, oh, you know, just sounds like a song. I couldn't tell the difference between that and anything else.
Now, there's various interesting elements to this case, but I think the most interesting element is this whole issue of soundalikes. Because although the allegation here isn't that the National Party deliberately set out to find a piece of music that sounded like Eminem's Lose Yourself, it is known that there are production music companies out there who will make available to advertisers and movies and TV shows, etc., music that sounds quite similar to commercially released music, the sales pitch almost being from those production music companies, you can license this music off us quite cheaply that sounds like something that's been in the charts that people are familiar with without actually having to go to the cost of licensing the original track, which will probably be much more expensive. And of course, it is not unknown for advertising agencies or people producing movies or TV or whatever to actually go to production music companies and say, could you make us something a little bit like this track, but not so like it that it would be copyright infringement, but so that we can use it in our advert or our TV program or a movie, either because we can't afford to actually license in the originally commercially released track, or maybe even, and there are certain examples where this has definitely happened, we tried to license the original track and the label or the publisher or the artist or the songwriter said no. We weren't allowed to use it, which is something we discussed a couple of years ago at the CMU conference at The Great Escape.
Yeah, we did. We had various people with experience of it and with knowledge of what to do when it happens. A panel at the 2015 CMU Insights conference. Among them was Simon Raymond from Bella Union, who talked about one of his artists on the label. They had a track that hadn't been released, but this advertising agency had come to them and said, we'd like to use this song on this advert. And the band straight away, no, that's not how we want to put this new song out into the world. And then he said, like 2 weeks later, the advert came on TV and he was like, they've gone and used it anyway. And then realised that it was a song that sounded very slightly different. And then there was a big legal fallout from that. We had actually a lawyer on the panel as well who discussed the best way to set yourself up for, well, not necessarily avoiding this problem, but putting yourself in a better position. If you do find sound-alike music used in an advert, particularly in the situation where they had come to you and asked. So this lawyer, Tahir Bashir, was saying that actually it's better if you just say no from the outset, that's better. If you start negotiations and then say no, because to a judge, it might then look like actually you were just angling for more money rather than had some sort of ethical or moral objection to your music being used in an advert. There was something else he said, which actually this is what happened in the Bella Union case, is that quite often if an advertising agency has an inkling or suspects that you're going to go the legal route against them, they will go and ask every musicologist in the country. And there aren't very many of them. They just go around and ask all of them to listen to the two tracks and give an opinion. Because then when you go to them and say, could you testify in court for us on this? They say, as I've already spoken to the other side, so it's a conflict of interest, I'm afraid I can't.
Yeah, the musicologists being those weird academics who show up in court occasionally to say either, yeah, these two tracks are basically the same track, or no, these two tracks are completely different, and we're never quite sure on what basis they are saying that. But I think the interesting thing that did come up in that conversation, although there may be some things that you could try and do to protect yourself, but if you are the victim of a sound-alike, so you've got a track out there and then an ad agency or whoever commissions a piece of music, which in your mind is basically a total rip-off of your track, but not exactly the same because they're clever enough to make a few things different. One of the problems is that this is a sort of a grey area of copyright law. And anything that's a grey area where there's some ambiguity, that makes it expensive to pursue litigation because you're not assured that you will win. And yet you will accrue significant costs in trying to fight that case, which obviously means that if you are a smaller independent label like Bella Union, or maybe you're a DIY artist in control of your own music, that puts you at a massive disadvantage because you're thinking, this is a risky case to pursue, we can't afford to lose and have to pay all those legal costs, so perhaps we just won't bother. Whereas it might be on the back of this case in New Zealand, and as one of the lawyers working for Eminem pointed out, copyright law in New Zealand is quite similar to copyright law in both Australia and here in the UK, they all sort of originate in the same body of English copyright law, that it might be that that's quite a convincing precedent that you could take to subsequently fight cases of this kind, of saying, no, look, the judge here said they did sound very similar, and even though the ad, the movie, the TV show, the whatever insists that they did the legitimate thing by either going to production music library or commissioning something, because they were clearly aware of the similarities prior to the ad going out, then there is a strong case there for copyright infringement. So potentially a decent precedent set there, which would be influential here in the UK. National Party have said that they are reviewing their options. So I don't know whether that means an appeal might come in or whether they would just rather write that cheque for 600 grand to make this story go away. As a political party, you don't really want to be rowing with Eminem in the press.
It can't be good PR, can it?
So we'll see what their next move is.
Still to come, we've got some news in brief and the end of Kid Rock's political career. But now, Wintel, which sounds like it might be either a window cleaner or an internet provider, but it's neither.
No, it is a new report that is coming out annually. We can now say that because this is the second edition, so it's the second time they brought it out. It's published by the Worldwide Independent Network, or WIN for short. So it's WIN and Intel. It's Wintelligence, I guess.
World Independent Network Intelligence
is where the name is coming from. So WIN brings together all of the trade bodies for the independent music sector around the world. So obviously we have the Association of Independent Music here in the UK, which is one of the first really organised trade bodies for independent labels specifically. There are counterparts of AIM all around the world, and then they are united through this organisation called WIN. So I suppose it's kind of an indie label version of the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry. IFPI, of course, bring out their own report every spring that brings together stats from record industries all around the world and gives us an overview of how recorded music is performing. And in some ways, this report, although the independent labels contribute to the IFPI research, so that IFPI report that comes out in the spring, that includes the majors, but also all of the independent data as well. But there are a handful of things about the way the wider record industry presents its stats that the indie labels don't like, which is why they have now introduced this new report called Wintel, which I suspect will be coming out on an annual basis, which in some ways is taking the same figures IFPI are using in the spring, but processing them in a different way, so to represent the independent labels in what Wynn would claim is a much fairer way.
Yes, because I mean their specific issue is with the way market share for all the labels from major down to indie is presented, because the major labels take up the bulk of that market share. However, Wynn argues the major labels report the revenues of any independent label who is distributed through a major label's distribution network as part of their market share. I mean, this report reckons that that accounts for $1.2 billion worth of the overall market share, which they say the major labels are claiming that should actually be attributed to the independents.
Yeah, so the big difference is when you look at all the revenue that's coming in from the use of recorded music worldwide, how do you attribute it to the majors and to the indies? Do you do it based on who is actually distributing the content? So who is the entity that is ultimately providing the content to an iTunes or a Spotify or whoever? Or do you do it based on who actually owns or controls the copyright? And as you said, there is a decent chunk of independent record companies in the world who own or control the copyrights and the recordings that are on those labels. But in order to get that content out there, whether that's physical content out into record shops or increasingly it would be digital content into iTunes and the streaming services, they tap into a third-party distributor, because many independent labels rely on another company or other companies in order to actually get their content into a Spotify or into an Apple. And some of those distribution companies are ultimately owned by the majors, Sony, Universal and Warner. So obviously Universal have their Caroline International division that does label services and distribution for indie labels. Warner have ADA, or the Alternative Distribution Alliance, that distributes on behalf of indies. And then Sony have the powerhouse that The Orchard has become, that distributes for lots of independent labels, and The Orchard has bought up a lot of other indie label distributors in recent years. So that's now a really big part of the distribution business. But what that means is when Sony is calculating its market share, it's including The Orchard's revenues, and likewise Universal with Caroline and Warner with ADA. And the indie labels say that paints a misleading picture of who actually owns and controls the recordings that are generating the revenue in the wider record industry. And so this report aims to put that right.
Now, aside from bragging rights, there is a reason why the indie labels having their market share pushed down or brought up again, as this report tries to do, does matter. And that's that in the music streaming world, what royalties you get is often based on your market share. So if the indie labels are being presented as having a much lower market share than they actually do, that means they're getting much less money than they actually should.
Yeah, because streaming deals are quite complicated, as we have discussed on many occasions on our podcast, there are various elements to the streaming deals, and some of those elements are influenced by the market share of the label or the distributor who is doing the deal. And the general rule is the bigger the market share, the more equity you get in startups, the more advances you can probably demand, maybe even the better royalty rates you can get. And therefore, the independent distributors and Merlin, which obviously negotiates template deals in the streaming space for a lot of indie labels, they're very keen to be able to say to digital companies, yeah, those market share figures you get over there that the majors put out, they're actually misleading. Look, here's some different market share figures based on copyright ownership rather than distribution. And therefore, our market share is higher than you probably think, and therefore we should be getting better terms. In terms of some of the standout stats that you can find in the latest edition of the Wintel report,
indie labels' global revenues came to over $6 billion in 2016. That's what they reckon. And as I already said, the major distributed indie revenue is $1.2 billion. That's the revenue that the indies reckon should be attributed to them rather than the majors. The overall share of indie labels since 2015 into 2016 grew by 0.9% up to 38.4% globally.
So yeah, so that's the indie label sector is controlling not far off 40% of the recorded music market, which might surprise some people, because often when we're talking about how the different market share are distributed, it's quite common to think of the indie labels controlling maybe a quarter, maybe up to about 30% of market share. Whereas here we're saying, you know, over 38%. But I suppose that's because here in the UK, we have a very Anglo-American centric view of the world. And when it comes to the Anglo-American repertoire, the majors are much more dominant. But in some other countries, actually, the indies are much more significant. So when you look at it globally and you look at copyright ownership rather than distribution, it is quite an impressive control of the market that the indies have together.
Yeah, well, there's a breakdown of market share country to country. And actually, in the UK, the indie label market share is only 22%, so much lower than the global average. The biggest increase, 2015 to 2016, was the US, though, which went up 1.7% to 37.3%. You say there's a bit of an imbalance with the Anglo-American repertoire, but actually it's very different between the US and the UK. It's actually in Asia where indies really dominate. In Japan, although the indie label share fell slightly, 0.3% in 2016, the overall indie label share there is 63.3%.
Well, that's partly aided by one company.
Yeah, that's because Win count Avex as an indie label.
Whenever we talk about the Japanese music industry, we always say, don't we, there are four majors in Japan and we count Avex as one of the majors.
If you go and speak to anyone from Universal, Warner or Sony in Japan, they will talk about Avex as a direct competitor, not as one of the indies. So it's a slightly, I don't know. It's a slightly dubious claim.
Well, it all comes down to how the hell do you define what a major is. If you choose to define a major as a record company that is in some way owned by Sony, Universal and Warner, full stop, then they are right to say we're going to count Avex in with the indie sector in Japan.
It's actually, although Japan there has a very high indie label share, it's not the highest, second highest. The highest is South Korea, which they claim has 89% indie label market share. I don't really know the label structure in South Korea, so I can't comment on whether they've got a load of majors.
Yeah,
that Win are claiming, but that's almost no majors at all.
Yeah, Sony, Universal and Warner have a lot of work to do if they want to be big in K-pop, by the sound of it. And it is interesting, some of those Asian markets are where people see huge potential for growth coming up in the streaming market. So some of those countries, perhaps not so much Japan, but like China and India, which are markets where actually the amount of money made by recorded music in the past wasn't particularly significant because piracy was so high in the physical domain. People are very excited about the potential growth of the digital space there, particularly with streaming services being bundled with mobile packages. But I suppose the interesting thing is, as streaming becomes a big deal in those countries, it's not necessarily Sony, Universal and Warner or the big Western labels who will see the benefit of that. It will be local independents. Although I would suspect that as those markets really start to come into their own, we could probably expect to see Sony, Universal and Warner trying to buy up some of the indies in those regions, or at the very least some of the indie distributors in those regions, in order to have more of a dominance in those countries. Although if the latter of those scenarios occurs, that will make Win even more adamant to put these annual figures out to present the market share stats in a way that the indie labels believe is fairer.
Yeah, so I guess we'll be back again next year to see how the indie label market share has gone up or down, and if this report has any influence over how streaming services do deals with indies. Just very quickly, time for some news in brief now. And Chris, do you remember last week where we joked that it had been a massive waste of time talking about the Pirate Bay's .se domain for 5 minutes at the end of the podcast?
Yeah, last week we were talking about how the Pirate Bay.se had gone offline, ceased to exist. But then at the end of our conversation about that, our conclusion was because domain names are sort of irrelevant in the age when everyone navigates the internet by Google search, it had been a waste of time for us to talk about the Pirate Bay.se going offline.
Yeah, and now it's double pointless because it's working again.
It's back online.
So that's good.
So there you go. I don't think we actually explained on last week's podcast, despite us talking about the Pirate Bay's domains at quite some length, that the reason why we thought the Pirate Bay.se had gone offline is because with the Swedish authorities trying to seize that domain, the courts have put the domain on ice, as it were. And because the domain is on ice, when it came up for renewal, the people who are now running the Pirate Bay were not able to renew it. But somebody has renewed it, so we don't know whether that is the court has renewed it because they put it on ice and so they have control over the domain, or whether something happened and the Pirate Bay people, who are all anonymous these days, were able to renew it. But whatever happened, the PirateBay.se is now working. But not if, like me, you're a Virgin Media customer in the UK where there is a web block. And because I would never circumvent a web block, it is not available to me.
Sticking with piracy or not, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has put out a statement saying that stream ripping does not necessarily constitute copyright infringement, and therefore the record company should not be trying to get companies that offer that service forced offline.
I don't know if we mentioned this on the podcast recently. I have a feeling that we did. We certainly reported on it on the CMU Daily. The Recording Industry Association of America recently gave its annual submission to a thing called the Notorious Markets Report, which is a thing that the US government puts together. And it was in that that the record companies in America were saying, okay, we got YouTube MP3 offline. We sued them out of business so people can no longer rip audio off YouTube videos through that website, but there are lots of other stream ripping websites. They're all evil and stream ripping must be stopped. And so that was what the record companies were saying in their submission. So basically this report from the EFF, which calls itself a digital rights lobbying group, was countering that and saying just because a service offers stream ripping, it doesn't necessarily mean they are liable for copyright infringement, because it might be that people using those sites are only using them to rip the audio off videos where the maker of the video is happy with people taking the audio. They want people to take the audio, and therefore it is a legitimate service, says the EFF.
Finally, a bit of legal news. We discussed Spinal Tap recently, and their case against Vivendi has been resubmitted to court. Previously, when we've discussed this story, we've talked about Universal Music owner Vivendi, but now we can just talk about Universal Music, because Universal Music has been added to the lawsuit. So it's definitely proper music news now.
It certainly is, yeah. So the creators of This Is Spinal Tap were requested to resubmit their litigation because three of the four had sued through companies rather than as individuals. And the court said, no, you need to sue as individuals. They also wanted more information about the fraud allegations that the Spinal Tap creators have made. There's a lot more information about those fraud allegations in the resubmitted lawsuit. And yes, as you say, Universal Music has now been specifically listed as a co-defendant because although it is Vivendi's movie company, Studio Canal, that owns the rights in the movie, Universal, as it happens, own the rights in the soundtrack. So Universal itself has been added as a co-defendant, and we look forward to seeing what happens with this lawsuit next.
So you can slap setlistpodcast.com into your web browser, and you'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of those stories and all of the stories we're discussing this week in there. And finally this week, Kid Rock is not the new Donald Trump, so you can rest easy. This is, of course, the news that's been running since July that Kid Rock was going to run for the US Senate when the elections happen in a year's time. But now he said, of course he's not. He's never intended to. Just because he said repeatedly that he was and argued with anyone who said that he was joking doesn't mean that he ever intended to actually do it.
Yes, all the speculation about whether or not Kid Rock's claim that he was going to run for Senate were true sort of happened when we were on break with the podcast. So we didn't really talk about this much on the podcast because most of it was in July and August, although we did report on it quite religiously in the CMU Daily, because Kid Rock put up this website that seemed to be a campaign website. So he was going to run a campaign to be a senator when the midterm elections happen next year. And then he started talking about it and giving interviews about it. And I don't know whether they were in on the joke or whether they fell for it too, but you then had supporters of the Republican Party, including some organizations who are quite proactive in funding the election campaigns of Republican candidates, coming out and saying, oh, Kid Rock would be a great candidate for Senate. He would be a really good Republican representative in Senate. We'll give some funding to this guy. We really hope that he's going to go through with this.
The big red flag that it was a hoax was that he never submitted an application to stand for election. So that's going to be a problem. But a few months earlier in February, it had emerged that the local branch of the Republican Party had considered asking him to stand for them, because obviously after Donald Trump is elected as president, everyone's going to start thinking, who would we previously have thought it would be insane to put on the stand that we could now actually put up there? There were two strands of fundraising chat on this. There was someone from a Republican Party funder organization who said, like you said, yes, oh, he would be brilliant. We really hope he's going to go forward and do it. He's a smart guy. He knows about policy. He'd be great. And then there was a fundraising email sent out by the senator from Massachusetts who basically like put fear up the potential funders by saying, oh, don't be complacent about this. He might actually do it. And oh, if he gets in, what are we going to do? Which, given that she was raising money for a different state, wouldn't really stop him from doing anything.
But it materialises via an interview on the Howard Stern radio show. It was always a publicity stunt because he's got a new record to sell. He never intended to stand. It was all a joke and we're all idiots for falling for it.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. It was obvious I wasn't going to do it because I've got an album coming out and a tour, although I'm not sure anyone who fell for this joke thought that he'd actually properly thought it through. So I don't know having an album and tour in his schedule really would necessarily affect that.
Yeah, because what he was suggesting was he's going to be so busy for the next year with his album launch and then a pretty long tour after that. He was clearly not going to have time to campaign for the Senate elections as they're coming up. But yeah, as you said, well, you said two things in your write-up in the Sincere Daily, which is A, well, we all just assumed that he was approaching it in quite a shambolic way and hadn't really brought it through. And secondly, post-Trump, you feel you can't be complacent by writing off any weird celebrity bid for a career in politics. And he would have been running against a sitting Democrat senator.
Yes.
So you can see why perhaps the local Republicans who have not won this seat in recent elections were thinking, well, it might seem weird having this rock star as our candidate, but it's worked before. Perhaps it could work
now. Nothing seems weird in politics anymore. I mean, he's already had dinner with Trump at the White House, so he's already well in there. I still wouldn't be surprised if he suddenly changes his mind. He did say in this interview with Howard Stern, it had kind of blown up more than he ever thought it would. Because really, this website he set up, it was a picture of him sitting in a slightly political-looking office, selling merch that said Kid Rock for Senate. Like, there was no policy, there was nothing else on it. It was a very sparse website. But then he said certain people in his team who knew from the outset that it was a joke were like, hang on, are we actually doing this? And he had to keep reassuring them that it wasn't going to happen.
So Kid Rock is not running for Senate, so that means we're not going to see the Kid Rock v. Kanye presidential election in the early 2020s. Although, as you say, these days, who knows? That could still happen.
That's it for this week's show. You can find us on all the social media if you want to engage with us throughout the week after you've listened to it. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram with Setlist Pod. And as of last week now, you can find us on LinkedIn. Yeah, that's right. You can find us on LinkedIn. What of it? You can also subscribe, rate and review this show wherever you found it, or wherever you can go looking for it as well. Once you've found it in one place, it's like an internet treasure hunt, going out and finding Setlist in different places.
Yeah, listen to every edition on a different platform. That should be the challenge.
You should also tell at least two friends about the show.
Oh, two friends.
Two friends, always two friends. Three. Four. How about two friends and your mum?
Yes.
Okay. We've negotiated. Anyway, that is it for this week. Setlist is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.